NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Medicaid cuts are coming, and rural communities like ours may feel it most. As President Trump's new mega bill rolls out, local hospitals like Ellenville Regional say they're bracing for a crisis. Hear what CEO Stephen Kelly told Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar about the potential fallout. It's a musical conversation across the centuries. Composer Andrew Wagner tells us about the Weekend of Chamber Music coming up next week, how it's bridging the old and the new. And a legend in his own mind and on stage, Jonathan Charles Fox. He brings stories, laughs, and his one dog named Gidget to a one-man show like no other. We'll have more from him, plus our own Janice Adams on the importance of public radio during our summer fun drive. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. After Russia launched another large drone missile attack on Ukraine with an hours-long assault overnight that left at least two people dead, Secretary of State Marco Rubio met with his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, in Malaysia on the sidelines of the ASEAN conference on Russia's war in Ukraine and ongoing peace talks.
I echoed what the president has said, of both disappointment and frustration at the lack of progress in peace talks or in a path forward.
This is the U.S. resumed weapons shipments to Kyiv. Meanwhile, Senate Majority Leader John Thune says a vote could come this month on bipartisan legislation imposing severe sanctions on countries that continue to buy Russian oil.
I hope that we can get it on the floor before the August recess. We are working with the administration, with the House, to try and get it in a form where it's ready.
This as President Trump's frustration with Russia grows over the lack of a ceasefire deal. In Los Angeles, more than 31 workers building an underground tunnel for a wastewater treatment plant have been rescued after a partial collapse. Steve Futterman has more.
The collapse occurred in the early evening. Officials say the trapped workers had to climb through debris up to 15 feet high. The massive 7-mile underground tunnel is designed to return wastewater that's been treated back into the ocean. When the collapse occurred, more than 100 first responders raced to the scene. A triage unit was set up. Fortunately, it was not needed. L.A. Mayor Karen Bass.
I was so concerned that we were going to find tragedy. Instead, what we found was victory. All of the men that were in that tunnel rescued.
The rescue workers inside a giant cage were lifted out of the tunnel by a crane. There will be an investigation to determine what caused the collapse. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
Stocks are in mixed territory this morning as President Trump issued new tariff threats. NPR Scott Horsley reports the Dow gained about 45 points in early trading.
President Trump is threatening to impose a 50% import tax on all goods from Brazil as of August 1st, even though the U.S. has a trade surplus with that country. Trump says he's calling for the steep tariff because of Brazil's treatment of its former president, Jair Bolsonaro, a Trump ally who's facing criminal charges for allegedly trying to overturn his 2022 election loss. Stock in Delta Airlines took off after the company reported better-than-expected quarterly profits. Delta says demand for air travel has leveled off about where it was last year, which is better than the company was projecting a few months ago. And the maker of Nutella is buying cereal maker Kellogg in a deal valued at just over $3 billion. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
And on Wall Street, the Dow was up 48 points. The Nasdaq is down 83. The S&P 500 down 8. You're listening to NPR News. Senate Democrats are releasing text messages and emails to support the accusations of a Justice Department whistleblower. NPR's Kerry Johnson reports this move comes as lawmakers consider the judicial nomination of a top DOJ official.
Emil Bovey served as a defense lawyer for President Trump before playing a major management role inside the Justice Department. Now Bovey's in line for a lifetime tenured job on the Federal Appeals Court in Philadelphia. Democratic Senator Richard Durbin says Bovey belongs nowhere near the federal bench. Durbin citing text messages, emails, and other records to back a whistleblower who says Bovey and others misled a federal court and disregarded a court order in immigration cases this year. year. Bovee denies that. If Senate Republicans stick together, they can confirm him in a simple majority vote. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
In Thailand, thousands of people from around the world are flocking to the Khao Kheo Open Zoo to celebrate the first birthday of Mu Deng. She's a baby pygmy hippo that's become a social media sensation. To celebrate her day, she took a few naps, ate a watermelon and vegetables before she was hosed down for a shower. She also got a 44-pound hippo-sized cake. Baby pygmies are native to West Africa, and they are endangered. There are only a couple thousand of them left in the world. I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Our summer fund drive is underway, and it's our biggest chance to raise funds that keep this station thriving and keep us as your trusted source for local news, music, and stories from the heart of the Catskills, Northeast Pennsylvania, and beyond. We're 27% of our goal, and we need to hear from you to keep it going, keep that momentum going to reach the $55,000 goal we have set. 845-482-4141, or you can donate at wjffradio.org. Make a donation now, and whether that's $50 or $500, your support ensures that the independent news and diverse voices and the great music stay on the air, commercial-free, for the good of everybody in the community, for the public. We need your help now at 845-482-4141 or wjffradio.org. And your support supports reporters like Kimberly Izar, who is up next with a story to talk about how Medicaid cuts could impact rural hospitals. According to the state's Department of Health, more than 6 million New Yorkers rely on Medicaid, but that coverage is now in jeopardy. President Trump's recently signed so-called Big Beautiful Bill includes sweeping Medicaid cuts, and lawmakers warn that as many as 1.5 million New Yorkers could lose access when that law takes effect. For rural hospitals, the consequences could be especially dire. Healthcare providers already are dealing with limited staff, tight budgets, and aging healthcare systems, and they say these cuts will only deepen the crisis in underserved areas. Kimberly Izar spoke with Stephen Kelly, president and CEO of Ellenville Regional Hospital in Ulster County, about how this new law could threaten the future of rural health care in the Catskills and beyond.
On the phone with me now is Steve Kelly, president and CEO of Ellenville Regional Hospital. Ellenville Regional is a community-based nonprofit hospital serving nearly 60,000 patients a year across New York's Hudson Valley, including Ulster, Sullivan, and Orange counties. Steve, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're most welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. So let's start with the local impact of what we're seeing at the federal level nationally. President Trump recently signed into law what he's calling the Big Beautiful Bill, which includes major changes to Medicaid, particularly ending coverage for those who don't meet new work requirements. I'm curious, from your perspective, what are the most immediate implications of this for people in our region?
Well, I don't think it'll have any significant impact until the beginning of next year, which is going to arrive very quickly, since we're already, partly through, almost halfway through July. The Healthcare Association of New York has analyzed it, and they are projecting about $6.7 billion of lost Medicaid revenue to New York State. Now, that we don't get all of that, but just to put that in perspective, if you were to take dollar bills and cover a square foot, it takes about $10 to cover a square foot. So to put in perspective how big this is, that is about the same as 15,500 acres.
Wow.
Which is more than the size of the island of Manhattan. So if you were to knock down all the buildings cut down all the trees and just get rid of everything on the island and then cover it with dollar bills, it would be more than that. So it is a lot of money. It is a lot of money for New York, and it is going to have a big impact. So New York has over 5 million people out of our approximately 20 million people are on Medicaid. So around 25% of the population.
Mm.
And it is estimated that the impact of the bill by Haney's, is their estimate, will reduce the number of people in New York that are on Medicaid by about 1.5 million. So 1.5 million of 5 million is be like 30% or 28%. So it's going to have a major impact on the people who are eligible to be on Medicaid. So the way that it works is that private providers are able to see or not see any particular insurance, or hospitals, on the other hand, are required by law to take care of everyone who can get through the door, whether they have insurance or not. And so this between the cuts to Medicaid that will reduce reimbursement, combined with the health care of last resort being the hospitals, this is a big cut to hospitals, and it's going to have a big impact. We don't know exactly how much for each county yet. I'm sure Haney's will be working on that, but it's only just been signed into law, and so it's only been analyzed at more of a macro level.
Yeah, I want to ask a little bit more about the impact that this may have on hospitals in rural communities. You know, here in the Catskills, we face particularly unique challenges being in a rural environment. Providers have for a while now named an already strained healthcare system. They've cited staffing shortages, limited resources, financial instability. Can you walk me through some of the key issues that rural hospitals are already grappling with and how this legislation may impact rural hospitals like Ellenville Regional?
Well, it is not a secret that rural hospitals service a lot of Medicaid recipients. Many of them live in rural areas. In Ellenville, a relatively poor community, it's disproportionately poor to, you know, a lot of areas. It's going to hurt. It's definitely going to hurt. It is the second largest payer for us after Medicare. And so that's pretty significant. It's approximately a third of our income comes from Medicaid. So any cut to Medicaid is a pretty big cut. You know, that goes right to us. And if we have uninsured people, then what happens is when in many cases they're not able to afford to pay their bill, that becomes bad debt to us. And so while it shows up as revenue initially, it becomes bad debt in the long run and reduces our revenue. And when you look at hospitals across New York and across the country, but New York, a lot of hospitals are in the untenable situation of not being able to cover their costs with their revenues. And so they're...
This is a test of the Sullivan County Emergency Alert System. In the event of an actual emergency, this system would bring you important information. This test of the emergency alert system is now concluded.
James Bettinato recently said that despite efforts to expand services, his hospital still serves an underserved area and that the proposed cuts could eventually force them to scale back and put vulnerable patients at greater risk. Have you been in contact with other rural hospitals in the region, and how are y'all preparing for this moment?
Well, I have not been in contact with a lot of other rural hospitals, but I do. You know, the Healthcare Association of New York has been modeling this, and I'm sure within a few weeks they'll have more information that will make it more clear. But, you know, I think it will be difficult for us. How difficult? I don't know, because it hasn't happened yet, and we haven't. We don't know, but I know that if we were to lose, say, a third of our Medicaid business, that would certainly put us into a negative spin, and we would be forced to figure out what we could do to reduce costs. And, you know, we run a pretty lean ship here, so there's not a lot of fat to trim off. And so we would be looking at any programs that do not provide contribution margin, and those would be ones that we would have to evaluate whether we could continue providing them.
Well, as you said, there's still a lot that we don't know. What have you heard from patients about how they're feeling right now?
I don't think it's trickled down yet. I think that people don't realize the magnitude of anything until there's an actual impact on them, and that hasn't happened yet and won't for a while. But that doesn't mean that we don't have to worry about it. We're planning. Once we know what it looks like, then we'll start to work to figure out what we can do to mitigate it. And we have to wait and see what New York State does. The state has been very supportive and will probably look to figure out ways to assist the hospitals. They don't want hospitals to close.
And as you plan for the future, who do you foresee to be the most impacted by these spending cuts?
There are requirements in the bill there's work requirements, so able-bodied people, I'm not exactly sure how that's defined, are going to be kind of ineligible. So those folks will be impacted a great deal. I think folks, you know, just in general, if they are not able, if they're like the working poor in many cases have been able to get insurance products through the Obamacare plans. If those become too expensive because they're not funded as heavily, that would create people not having access to healthcare, and accessing the healthcare system through the emergency department is a very expensive way to do it. It's much, much less expensive to have primary care and have regular care so that people don't get sick. And if they do get sick, it gets caught a lot sooner
right,
before it's really serious. So it really is going to be a bad, or I shouldn't say, I don't know about bad. I don't know how it's going to impact us, but I worry that it could. That's all.
Steve, anything else you want to add about what's at stake for rural healthcare in New York that maybe we haven't already discussed?
Well, I think that rural healthcare in New York is already greatly stressed. We have incredible provider staffing shortages in our country, and rural New York is particularly hit with that. Whether it's doctors, nurses, rad techs of every flavor, pharmacists, physical therapists. I mean, healthcare is very broad. It has many, many licensed people, and they are all in very short supply. It is extremely difficult to recruit to rural areas. People graduating from school are interested in paying off their debts, which are quite steep. It costs a lot of money to get through college. And they want to start families, and so they're very interested in being near their own families to have their extended families help with daycare. And unless they're from a rural area, they really aren't that interested in even considering it. So in more suburban areas or urban areas, there is a lot of opportunity, and they get paid more in those areas. And that's where they gravitate. So we in rural areas are really struggling for providers. And if we can't get providers, then we have to hire them through agencies at really quite great expense. And they're here only temporarily, and then they leave. So they don't ever get rooted in the community as was more common in years past. I just think it will just stress everything even more if our funds are stressed more than they are already.
I've been chatting with Steve Kelly, president and CEO of Ellenville Regional Hospital. Steve, I really appreciate your time, and thank you again so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And thanks to Kimberly Izar for that report. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about our summer fun drive. Yes, it's still going on, so we do need to talk about it, but we're going to talk about it with someone who has a long history with public radio, and we'll talk about that history and the importance of public radio with our own Janice Adams right after this break. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Hello, I'm Michelle Martin. How's the newspaper where you live? Thin? Getting thinner? Publishing a few days a week, if at all? You're not alone. Over the past couple decades, the U.S. has lost about a third of its newspapers, taking thousands of local journalists off their beats.
It will sell off more of its daily newspapers.
The largest news organization is shrinking.
It's laid off nearly a quarter of its newsroom.
And that makes it harder to keep up with our elected officials and what they're doing. A functioning democracy and functioning local journalism go hand in hand. We're trying to do our part, and that's why we need you to do your part by keeping NPR and the station strong with a donation today. And we thank you.
Your gift keeps local news, culture, and NPR funded and freely available to the entire community. Give what you can to keep it going. It's so important right now. Donate at wjffradio.org.
You can call us too at 845-482-4141 or again, go to wjffradio.org. Donate now during our summer fun drive. And as you heard there, it's so important like never before. And someone who can tell us a little bit more about the importance of public radio and her experience with it is Emmy Award-winning journalist, historian, and host of the Janice Adams Show here on Radio Catskill, Saturdays at 11. It's Janice Adams. Janice, good morning.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, everyone.
I wanted to mention that, you know, your history with public radio stretches far and wide there, not only because you, you know, of course, host your show here. You were NPR's first arts reporter, I understand, I think, and also you opened the New York Bureau, is it 50 years ago this winter? Is that correct?
I am shocked to realize, and I'll tell you how I realized it, because it just came to me this week. I hadn't thought about it, but yes, come this winter, it will be my 50th anniversary in and around NPR. I had been, you know, in local radio, but before we referred to it as public radio in the way we do now. And I had been at a small station, WFCR, in Amherst, Massachusetts, which is one of the college-sponsored stations. So that, too, is how this amazing network, when we are talking about preserving public radio, we're also talking about this tradition of independent stations that truly rise from community. They rise from universities. Many of them are joint licensees with universities. Interestingly, all of that is under attack, and so is public radio. But anyway, I came to it because I had co-anchored the Watergate hearings. And that was a main feature of what was going on. And our area in Amherst was said to have, I don't know that it's absolutely true, but it's just an interesting sidebar, said to have more people on Nixon's enemies list than any other place in the country. And as a result, my co-anchoring the Watergate hearings brought me to that and other things. I was really at that point bringing women's programming, issue-oriented women's programming to the air, which had not been done before at the local station. And so all of these things marked a real departure in how the public got to grasp what was going on and follow along with what was going on, uninterrupted at times because of public broadcasting, and really participate in this democracy. And so it's, I just see them side by side and step by step with saying, oh no, this cannot be let go, this cannot be set aside. After beginning moving from WFCR in Amherst to, I was invited to come to NPR. I was the first national arts correspondent. I was the originating national arts correspondent. And everything was so new that when I began, I actually began in the offices of the Canadian Broadcasting Company, CBC. And that was where our first studios were. And then we participated in the building out of the brand new studio at 801 Second Avenue in Manhattan, which was pivotal and wonderful because it was two blocks away from the UN.
Oh, yeah. So you were right there with all of the, you know, international newsmakers and or have access
exactly
to them.
And a veteran reporter whose name is not mentioned enough now, but Pauline Frederick, who had been one of the prime women to enter into issue-oriented broadcasting. She was stationed at the UN. She was covering the UN. So once we moved to 801 Second Avenue, you know, there was Pauline Frederick at least once a week coming in. 1976 was also pivotal because it was the presidential conventions. It was the national conventions, and New York happened to host that year's national convention. Yeah. So, and it was quite a forum, and you know, on the heels of recent memory, the previous convention that had been in Chicago, when Mayor Daley unleashed the police riot on demonstrators. So all of that was so pivotal, and public radio, and then also the early days of the NewsHour, but public radio was the one that could be more present than public television could be.
We're talking to Dr. Janice Adams from the Janice Adams Show. It's our summer fun drive, 845-482-4141 or wjffradio.org is where you can go to support public radio. Talk a little bit about her history and the history of that New York Bureau for NPR in Manhattan on 2nd Avenue. Can you tell us a little bit more about that bureau there, what it was sort of like? I went back and looked at something Scott Simon was reminiscing on when the bureau actually moved a few years ago from that location, and how you never kind of knew who was coming through the door there.
You never knew. The three people at the, quote, bureau were Seal Muller, who remained a longtime engineer with NPR and actually moved over to the new building and all of that. But it was at 801 Second Avenue for many years before they moved in New York to a location right off Bryant Park, right behind the huge main library there. With the lions.
And,
but so the three of us were Seal Muller as the engineer, and Robert Nathan, who was a national correspondent as well. It was the three of us. And Bob Nathan then left NPR to do what? To join the Law and Order franchise as one of its executive producers. So he did not return to public radio after that, I think, except for interviews.
Yeah, and you know, being there and, you know, starting that up and seeing how you had so many different people that were you're encountering there, from, you know, politicians to artists, musicians, it must have been an exciting time.
It was, and I want to say that it was really the legacy of Bob Zelnick and Russell, Jim Russell. Those were the two senior NPR people who built out the whole news structure. And Bob Zelnick, he had an interesting history because he was the one who did the Nixon-Frost debate and was responsible for producing and moving that entire, you know, that was internationally significant to have those conversations. So Bob Zelnick came from that background. And I want to say, you know, just in terms of temperature of things, when I was asked to come, I was asked, well, who could you interview if you could interview anybody in the world? And I chose Paul Robeson. Paul Robeson being a dean, a human rights dean, and an activist, singer, actor, who was almost beaten to the ground by the McCarthy era and by the smears and the are you now or have you ever been a communist? His passport taken away so that he could not travel, he could not perform. And it cost him dearly. And when I started, and that's how I just realized that it was my 50th year, I was looking him up, and his dates came up. I did not get to interview Paul Robeson, but the very first story I did for NPR was covering his funeral in New York.
845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org. It's our summer fun drive, talking to Dr. Janice Adams here. You mentioned earlier a name that was associated with public radio, but not in the best way. Well, actually, it turned out to be the best way. There was a proposal by then-President Richard Nixon back in 1969 to cut federal funding for public broadcasting. And someone that came to its rescue was someone we've talked about before. We've even played some of this testimony before. Fred Rogers, who was Mr. Rogers, host of that landmark children's television program, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, appeared in Washington before that Senate subcommittee in 1969 to express his disagreement with that proposal to cut that funding. Fast forward to today and federal funding for public media under attack again. We don't have a Fred Rogers to help us. Who's our Mr. Rogers?
I don't know who our Mr. Rogers is, but I do know that we are very unlikely to have another one if we do not protect public media.
Right.
What the gift was to children of public television in particular is immense. You have whole generations. LeVar Burton speaks of LeVar Burton is the actor who created Kunta Kinte in the landmark miniseries Roots. LeVar Burton also then, because of his own passion for children and reading, created Reading Rainbow. Those things have been in the ongoing attacks against public broadcasting, in the ongoing attacks, just sheer nonsense, whether or not some fictional character carried a pink handbag, and so it was encouraging children to be gay, as though you encourage anyone to be whatever they really are, which has nothing to do with your words, but their lives. It was crazy that they used that to smear and jeopardize children's programming on public broadcasting. Generations of children have come to their love of books and reading. Sesame Street has been marginalized. Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And LeVar Burton is not doing Reading Rainbow the same way. These are the results of attacks on the right and the right of people to have a broad as broad a knowledge base and a pool of information, truthful information, as we can, and then develop our critical thinking skills for good judgment and decision making. And the loss of that, the attack on that, is why right now we are going through another scandal of whether or because we have in our leadership someone who refuses to tell the truth consistently, refuses to even be conversant with it. And so there is another scandal right now, and I'm just waiting for the shoe to drop that will do something else explosive to take the scandal about the list of who a pedophile was friends with off the front pages. And we know that a new a shoe is going to drop. That's the pattern. But we also know that public radio is the one that's going to give not the story, but the audience, the respect and the perspective it deserves.
And we're sorry to interrupt you. We are listener supported radio, public radio, but we do receive some funding from the federal government. It's about 25% of our budget, and that is under threat right now as they're considering that rescissions package, which is meaning to, you know, claw back previously approved funding. This funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, through which we receive that federal funding, was approved in March by this president and this Congress. Now they're being asked to cancel that, take it back. And so I think
I do want to say one thing. This taking back needs to be put in perspective. If any of us defaulted on a contract, which is what it is, contracts have been signed with people, institutions all over, because that's what why the federal government, that's how our money is used for the good of all of us. And when you, it's not clawback, it's not rescind, it is defaulting on a contract. That is fraud. So we are being manipulated into turning all of truth and responsibility on its head. Public broadcasting, public radio, public television are essential to our critical well-being.
And I think that we can all be our own Mr. Rogers in a moment like this. I'm going to ask folks to do two things that Mr. Rogers might do. Make your donation now during our summer fund drive. Call 845-482-4141 or go to wjffradio.org and tell your senators to protect public media. You can call them. There's a link at protectmypublicmedia.org, which will connect you right to the office of your senator. It'll help you find them. It's a great tool to use. But yeah, help us stay strong and stay on the air by doing what Fred Rogers did. But we'll do it our own way. We'll take a group of us, an army of Fred Rogers on our own to do it.
Will we be our own neighbors?
Right. Perfect. Exactly. Janice Adams, thank you so much for coming in to talk to us today about this and your history with NPR and your great love of public media. And should I say happy anniversary?
Thank you.
Thank you, Janice. And again, tune into the Janice Adams Show on Saturday at 11, every Saturday here, for that great program that she brings us every week with your support. 845-482-4141, wjffradio.org. Support us now during our summer fun drive.
It's Leila Faldin from NPR's Morning Edition. The demonization of fact-based journalism is one of democracy's biggest threats. This aversion to truth has taken hold as the number of local newsrooms has dwindled, leaving reams of disinformation to fill the void. In public radio, we have a responsibility to counteract disinformation. This station is an oasis amid all the noise and fiction. Having a reporter at the school board meeting, at City Hall, that is our resistance to the undermining of a free press. We resist by being there, by providing platforms for people to see themselves reflected and to see difference. We resist by building bridges and by holding people to account. We do it thanks to you. You give us the tools we need to fight attacks on truth by donating to this station. Here's how.
Give now at wjffradio.org.
Or call 845-482-4141, wjffradio.org, or 845-482-4141. I want to mention that Janice will be live, Janice Adams live, this Saturday at 11 for our Summer Fun Drive, a special live edition of the Janice Adams Show. That's this Saturday at 11. You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi is sitting down with master storyteller Jonathan Charles Fox to talk about his one-man show, Get Off My Lawn, from childhood tales to stage life with his dog, Gidget. Fox promises an evening of laughter, reflection, and a few surprises, and quote, a conversation between good friends where I do most of the talking. Quote. Here's Valerie and Jonathan Charles Fox.
Hello, Jonathan, and welcome to Radio Chatskill.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
I am delighted to be interviewing you. I think this is the first time I've done an interview with you.
Is that so?
Yes.
Gosh, we've known each other a long time. Well, better late than never.
Let's see. Get off my lawn.
No, you get off my lawn.
Now, that sounds like, you know, trouble.
Does it? The subheader, of course, what you're talking about is the title of my new one-man show.
Yes.
Which is coming up soon, this Saturday at the Hurleyville Performing Arts Center. And the concept behind it was that I'm just an angry old man at this point. Honestly, the subtext is from birth to death and all of the blank that comes in between.
And there's a lot of blank.
There's a lot of blank. Thank yeah. you. You get it.
Yeah, I get it.
A lot of blank. I've been around for a while.
Yes. You've done a lot of interesting things.
I think so. I've had a storied career.
You have had a storied career,
a colorful
correct.
Life. And that's why every great once in a while I decide it's time to sit down and tell people stories about that colorful life that I've led. And apparently I'm still leading.
And you've done these before, correct?
I have. This is my 10th one, I think, in 12 years. And each one of them kind of just springs up out of nowhere. And I think what's important for everyone to know, certainly your listeners, is that this is not a scripted show. This is not a memorized show. What I do is I'm a monologist, just as Spalding Gray was so famously before me. And I always admired him. And in a very sick, dark, twisted way, when we lost Spalding Gray, I said, oh, that leaves the door open a little bit of a crack for me to come out and do what I admired in him so much, which is to sit down with you guys and tell stories. But they're all two stories, so I don't have to memorize them. And each time it's a little bit different. And each time the theme is completely different. So this one, yeah, I get off my lawn. It's focusing probably on my anger and bitterness. You know what they say, bitter, party of one, bitter.
I don't understand. I don't see you as an angry old man.
Well, that's because you don't see me at home.
Oh.
Where I'm standing on my deck saying, get off my lawn. It's interesting. That is certainly the dichotomy. I mean, a good portion of my career has been that persona of the man about town.
Yeah.
And I'm out in the world because I cover arts and leisure, of course, for the River Reporter. And so I'm out with people having a good time, out to do something that's going to be a good time. So it's up to me to have a good time while we're doing it. But it's also my job. So I spend a lot of time saying, hi, honey. Look at those pretty earrings. How are the kids? And then when I get home, it's like, you know what? I could be alone for a minute. It wouldn't kill me.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I can understand
I
that.
I really crave my solitude. And I do live alone in the middle of the woods. I don't live alone. Of course, I have that dog named Gidget. But you know what I'm saying. And the older I get, and I am of a certain age, the less inclined I am to entertain. Let's just leave it at that.
Well, that happens, I see.
Does it?
I can see it in myself. Well, yes.
That's what's given birth to this new one-man show.
Yeah. But you also have a beautiful home with lots of interesting objects of art to keep you company.
I do. It's been a lifetime of collecting. And of course, now I'm on the other side of that. And if somebody walked into the house and said, I love that, I'm tempted to say, take it home with you, which is exactly what my mother did when she was my age. I do like things. I do. I'm very tactile. I like touch, feel. I appreciate beauty. I think one of the reasons we have eyes and ears and noses is for all those sensory experiences. I do think so. So I have surrounded myself with what I consider to be beautiful things. You know, beauty is in the eye. I once had somebody look at my living room and say, where's your grandmother's bedroom? I said, my grandmother's bedroom? Don't you live with your grandmother? I said, no, these are my things. This is my home. I guess I live like a grandma.
Well, you know, it's a different aesthetic now. Sure, with the white and the bear.
Yeah, I'm not for white and bear. Yeah.
No, make it
there. There's a Yiddish word for it. It's called ungepatschka. And that means there's a lot going on, which is what you just kind of indicated, because you have seen what my home looks like. And I got that from my mom. And I remember years and years ago, she visited me in California and she said, oh, honey, don't you think it's a little ungepatschka? I said, you know, pot to kettle. Come in, kettle.
Oh, you always make me laugh, Jonathan.
That's a good thing.
Yes, that's a gift. That is a gift.
Okay, it's a gift that keeps on giving.
Anything else you'd like to say before we conclude?
No, only that there are a few tickets left. I'm happy to say ticket sales have been fairly robust over there at the Hurleyville Performing Arts Center. Really, the whole reason I got there, the whole reason I'm there this weekend is that I went to see our friend Oliver King perform and do some readings, I think Langston Hughes, and I saw the powers that be at the Hurleyville Performing Arts Center. I said, how many seats are in this beautiful theater? And I said, well, I could probably fill this place, don't you think? Janet Karras, of course, I'm talking about. She created the Hurleyville Performing Arts, and I said, I bet I fill this room. And she said, make it so. That was 6 months ago, and here we are.
You're doing it.
I am. I'll be at the Hurleyville Performing Arts Center this coming Saturday, July 12th. Doors open at 7, and there will be something to do, and there's libations and popcorn and whatever. And then curtain is at 8, and as I said, I wouldn't let the grass grow under your feet. You told me you have to get tickets yet? You better pick them up.
I'm going to do it as soon as we're finished.
Yeah, you can go to hbacny.org and hit July 12th or go to their calendar or whatever it is you have to do. There's probably a big picture of me and my dog up there anyhow, because they're excited that we're coming.
Thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to come share this information with us.
It's my great pleasure. I would be remiss if I didn't mention that I will have a special musical guest with me, as I often do. Chuck Vassallo will be tickling the ivories and underscoring the stories as we move through the decades.
Good.
Thanks to culture reporter Valerie Manzi and a legend in his own mind, Jonathan Charles Fox. It is our summer fun drive. Donate now to support us at 845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org so we can continue to bring those stories and characters of the region, let you know what's going on. We want to thank Susan from Livingston Manor who donated. Thank you for calling, Susan. We appreciate your support. Our wheel of progress is moving right along. We're at 27% of our goal. Help us get that much closer with your donation now at 845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org. We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to learn more about the weekend of chamber music, which is coming up next week. This is Radio Chatskill.
When I sit down for an interview, I'm thinking about you. I'm Mary Louise Kelly from NPR. Not every day, but on the best ones, journalists get to ask people in power questions and hold them to account. There is a reason that freedom of the press is enshrined in the Constitution. At home and abroad, leaders make choices that affect your life. Their impulses and decisions need to be examined in as thoughtful and rigorous an interview as possible. Now, journalists don't do this work to score political points. We do it in the service of asking tough questions on your behalf so you and the world can hear the answers, or lack thereof. That is both a privilege and a responsibility. When you donate to this NPR station, you support journalism that does not back down. Here is how to give and how to help public radio hold powerful people to account.
Donate now at WJFFradio.org. Thank you.
You can can also call us at 845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org. Support us during our summer fun drive. We need your support more than ever. Help us stay strong, stay local, and stay on the air. Go to WJFFradio.org or call 845-482-4141. You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and the hills of the Catskills alive with music once again as the Weekend of Chamber Music returns for its annual summer season. This year's theme, The Great Tradition, spans three centuries of musical innovation. And joining us now is composer and violinist Andrew Wagner, artistic director of Weekend of Chamber Music, to tell us what's in store for the season. Hello. Oh, I don't have your mic on to say hello. Hello.
Hello.
There, we did it.
Good morning.
Hello. Tell me about The Great Tradition. What does this theme mean? And what does it mean for audiences and for you?
Well, you know, I would love to tell you about that. I feel more like talking about Radio Catskill because I just, you know, I used to work in public radio. I can't help pitching. So
yeah, well, good. It's automatic, right?
When you hear the number. And now, oh, good Lord. Call now and pledge. But anyway, The Great Tradition, this is what in brainy art circles we call everything up until roughly the 20th century, when everything went to hell in many people's minds. The Great Tradition, common practice, this is, you know, the marble busts on the piano. And what makes Weekend of Chamber Music unique, really, in the way that we do it, is the mix of new music and old music. And it's gotten to where we do often 60 to 70% new and 30% old. And audiences love it. And they keep coming back for more. They will follow us anywhere, which is a tremendous gift for us. And so this year we decided we're gonna invert the relationship just slightly and go back and focus on that tradition. But we're also going to bring it up to the present. So kind of the joke of the season is that the great tradition is still going on. It's still a great tradition, and it's being added to piece by piece by living composers. And so we have Schumann and Beethoven and Schubert. And we have Haydn, and then we have 20th century masters such as Copland and Gina Stera and Carlos Chavez. But then we also have our composer in residence, Augusta Reed Thomas, who is one of the foremost composers on the scene globally today, actually.
It tells a little bit more about Augusta Reed Thomas as the composer in residence and her impact on this festival and the theme.
Well, really, any gifted composer we bring, we could bill as part of the great tradition, because we're all working in this long-running kind of dialogue with older pieces for string quartet and for piano and for orchestra. And so if we really wanted to kind of cram someone in there, we could say, yes, they represent the great tradition. But with Augusta Reed Thomas, we're talking about somebody who worked closely with Daniel Barenboim at the Chicago Symphony, with Pierre Boulez, with the Paris Opera Garnier, with every major chamber ensemble in the country and many ensembles internationally. She's somebody whose music, even though it's recognizably contemporary, is clearly very much within this expanding, ever-evolving tradition. And so the title sort of came out of the blue. And then when I thought about who we are having, I thought Gusty, we call her Gusty.
We call her Gusty.
Gusty is that tradition. She embodies that tradition going forward.
Who are some of the other standout performers or guest musicians that are coming to join you this year, and what do they bring to the table?
Well, this is a good question because we have a standard core ensemble that we bring every year. We call them the WCM Beloveds. And several of them can't make it this year for one reason or another. And so this year we have a real infusion of new blood. So Caroline Stinson, my artistic co-director and better half, will be In the cello chair, as always, Nirit Pacht, perhaps the most beloved of the beloveds, will be back playing violin. But then we have two new violinists, Julia Glenn and Emma Frucht, both younger, both really fabulous artists, flexible, imaginative, brilliant. And so they bring something entirely new to the mix. And then a wonderful young violist, Yuchen Liu, who we're really excited about. He's been winning every viola award known to humankind, and there are more than you might think. And was a fellow at the Marlborough Festival and comes with major chamber music cred. And then folks may remember from last year the pianist Mimi Solomon, who everybody just instantly fell in love with. So Mimi will be back.
And so you guys are starting rehearsals on Monday, and then you have the evening with Augusta Reed Thomas opening things up on the 17th. Is that right?
On Thursday night.
Yeah. And then you go through the 26th?
We go through the 26th. It's Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And then the next week, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And this year, everything is at CAS.
Catskill Art Space.
With the exception of the second Thursday, which we'll talk about next week in more detail. But that'll be at the Eddie Adams Barn, our beloved home in the hills above Jeffersonville. We're also doing a free kids and family concert at CAS on Sunday morning, the 20th. And that's new for this year, and we're super excited about that. So you've got a lot of options, a lot of ways to hear us, and we just hope you'll come and hear as much of it as you can.
It's such a great tradition every summer, and I love how you're describing, you know, the nickname you have for Gusty, Gusty, your group of regulars, the Beloveds. There's a sense of community there that you've shaped. You've also created this community for the community. Like, people look forward to this every summer. So very exciting to be here.
We look forward to it. And part of the reason is that the community has really shaped us. They've embraced us. They've embraced the programming vision. And now with the arts ecosystem here, which is just stronger and stronger
and growing,
supportive. And a lot of it really, frankly, runs right through this building, which is another reason to call now and pledge your support to Radio Catskill. It's more important now than ever. And if you don't pledge, you'll lose it. It's just that simple. And you cannot let that happen.
Yeah, we cannot let that happen. 845-482-4141 or go to wjffradio.org and make your show a support, whether it's $50, $500, whatever it is. It supports the community. It supports exactly what you're saying. This location, this forum, this place where we amplify everything that's going on in the community, from arts to local stories to music, entertainment, everything, information that you need. That's why we're here. That's our mission. And I said this earlier this morning, like, it's called public radio. It's public. Yeah. We serve the public.
Right.
The opposite of that is commercial. We're not commercial. We're public. We're here to do that. That is our mission.
You are not serving shareholders.
That's true. And so call 845-482-4141. You are the shareholder. WJFFradio.org, the public. Andrew Wagner, Weekend of Chamber Music, thank you so much. Again, there's more information about this great tradition in the summer in the Catskills at wcmconcerts.org. You can see the full lineup. And we'll be talking again next week about something very special at the Eddie Adams Barn, too.
Yeah, and I believe we'll have Gusty here as well.
Oh, Gusty.
Yeah.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Catskill. Please donate at wjffradio.org or call 845-482-4141. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Hello, I'm Michelle Martin. How's the newspaper where you live? Thin? Getting thinner? Publishing a few days a week, if at all? You're not alone. Over the past couple decades, the U.S. has lost about a third of its newspapers, taking thousands of local journalists off their beats.
It will sell off more of its daily newspapers.
The largest news organization is shrinking.
It's laid off nearly a quarter of its newsroom.
And that makes it harder to keep up with our elected officials and what they're doing. A functioning democracy and functioning local journalism go hand in hand. We're trying to do our part, and that's why we need you to do your part by keeping NPR and the station strong with a donation today. And we thank you.
Your gift keeps local news, culture, and NPR funded and freely available to the entire community.
Give what you can to keep it going. It's so important right now. Donate at wjffradio.org.
Call 845-482-4141 or go to wjffradio.org. Donate during our summer fun drive and help us keep this public radio station going. It's WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at wjffradio.org. Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. We might see a stray shower or thunderstorm this afternoon. Otherwise, cloudy skies and a high near 80. Foggy and damp after midnight, according to the National Weather Service, low 63. Partly cloudy tomorrow, 83.